Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. I'm Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today I want to talk about something that, for at least a Western audience, is somewhat obscure for those who study Byzantium and old Russia, as I do full-time. It's very, very important. In fact, it's quite essential. But the topic has a lot to do with what brings empires down, what destroys societies. And it also deals with how American academics, I suppose English academics, Anglo-American professors, really don't do history at all. They simply impose a postmodern ideological agenda on whatever subject they're dealing with, would be the Middle Ages or, you know, ancient China or whatever it is. And so my topic is the revolt of the Zealots in Thessaloniki, and this is 1342 and 1350. The Zealot Party has quite a bit of literature on it, as much in English as it is in Greek. It is a fairly eccentric thing. I mean, this is somewhat of an ideological movement that took over a major city, overthrowing the nobles and instituting some kind of communal system in its place. It's essential for a whole lot of reasons. Number one, is, as I've mentioned, academics have butchered this to the point where it's completely unrecognizable. All they do is they take their own agenda and simply impose it on the day. Usually it's an anachronism. Number two, it's one of the illustrations of a point that I've made my whole career, is that people are generally irrational. Political democracy and capitalism, the market, is based on people are rational. And that people pursue the short term at the expense of the long term. Now, this is a parasite mentality. They know they're killing their host, but they don't care. Number three, it says a lot about what brought down the Byzantine Empire, or New Israel, as it was called. This was the resurrection of the Roman Empire in southeastern Europe. It was national in the sense that it was Greek. The elite had to speak Greek. Army leaders were Greeks, and of course their major opponents were the Italians, who, because of the difference in language and religion, saw themselves as opponents and, for the most part, enemies. Nations and religions don't vary very much. They grow and they fall together. There aren't a whole lot of examples of a strong national identity with pluralism in religions, something that even Bismarck understood in 19th century Germany, where he had to kick the Catholics out. He's going to build this centralized, uniform state. There's certainly examples of places where there's different religions. I mean, that's not what I mean. But where these religions have something to do with defining the people. The word culture comes from the cult. And this is absolutely an essential point. Nationalism is a study of religion. Christianity has to develop in an ethnic context or no one could understand it. Without ethnicity, there is no society, there is no unity, there is no language, there is no civic debate at all. Language is a shared universe of meaning. It's not just words on a page. So the Zealot revolt in the Byzantine Empire is absolutely essential. To understand the Middle Ages, and this is essential for the Orthodox Church as well, because it has quite a bit to do with the monastic life. Byzantium was a victim, in part, of capitalism. Capitalism has existed in all times and in all places, but it exists as a parasitic development and as an anomaly. It's the result of sickness, and it's seen that way. And some of you know Valentin Katasonov is one of my favorite Russian-speaking economists these days. He's kind of the Russian version of Paul Craig Roberts. And he lists 10 specific marks of a dying society. When a society is going out of existence, when it simply no longer has the immune system to fight its enemies, what does it start to look like? Now, it's true, we have to use language from our own experience, but it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see how this develops and how this changes over time and place. The first thing is that there's a transformation of the pursuit of wealth from something positively good, not a necessary evil, that money and wealth is a good in and of itself. Second, that this wealth accumulation doesn't have any purpose. You know, it's some very vague sense of pleasure or emulation or keeping up or, you know, some vulgar reason. It has no social purpose. Third, that because this kind of mentality is accepted, it radically alters society. It inverts the natural order. The spirit serves the material rather than the other way around. The fourth is what he calls mutations. Kind of the default mechanism, the default processes mentally of the society are radically altered. Relationships that at one time were cooperative, and generally speaking, nations and economies have, you know, historically been mostly cooperative rather than competitive institutions, that these are replaced by competition and greed. It's a symptom of a society falling apart. The fifth is a radically stratified class society. Because those who have already gained money and the power that goes along with it are in the best position to keep it and to gain more. It's irrational, and it leads to the rule of an oligarchy. The sixth mark is oligarchs to maintain themselves manipulate the desire of the lower classes to justify their own enrichment. So they talk about how they believe in that everyone should pursue their self-interest as they see fit, that somehow this is universal. And therefore, the oligarchs just have pursued their own self-interest just more successfully than you have. They see themselves as equal, and that we're all free to do this. But of course, the reality is that only their self-interest matters. If I get upset, no one cares. If Warren Buffett gets upset, everyone cares. Essentially, everyone's self-interest is as good as another one. It's this vague universal. And they're able to manipulate the desires of the plebeians for the sake of other proletarians, really. They manipulate their desires so as to make this acceptable. In America, it's often very sexual. You know, they provoke that desire and create things like pornography and for a fee to make it okay, to make it acceptable. When you do that, you remove any kind of intellectual foundation against oligarchy. The seventh mark is that these class relations eventually harden and freeze. It becomes what we would call feudal. It's based on rents, not profits. So then those who are the lower classes really have no incentive to work, because they see no purpose. Ninth, usury and what we would call today asset stripping become the main means of making money. And this is because no one has faith in the future of the system, and so no one is going to invest long term. It's not seen as stable. Everything is short term. So if that's the case, then usury and asset stripping, which are, you know, they have the same foundation. Usury means a heck of a lot more than just charging interest on loans. It's essentially the charging of a rent. And finally, it all revolves around the worship of money. the universal Mercury, the universal solvent. You know, Hermes, Mercury, is a symbol of commerce, as well as deception and destruction. Those are the 10 marks that Katasonov, and again, we're using modern terminology, but our job as historians is to go back and see how it applies elsewhere. But it's the same thing. The pursuit of self-interest, the creation of oligarchy, the destruction of communal identity. Because if you have a society based around competition, then you can't have a communal identity. The solvent eventually brings everybody into isolated egotistical cells. And the fraud, the scam here, is that it sounds like, you know, you're supporting this universal notion of freedom. You should do as we please, so long as it doesn't hurt anybody else. But of course, it's laughable, because that really only applies to a handful of people. The self-interest of some average guy is absolutely meaningless. No one cares, no one notices. It's a universal justification for what already exists, class rule. So understand that these, again, this is essentially capitalism, self-interest, the rule of money. It's always seen as a perversion. There's nothing normal about it. In fact, it's what happens when natural and normal forms of life have broken down. Up until recently, it was almost universally understood as a precursor to total collapse. Traditional societies, economic life was concentrated in the commune, the extended family. These were all cooperative institutions. But materialism ends up being something like, you know, the rule of the elites in concentrated urban populations over a countryside that's more scattered and very hard to organize. The world trade in goods and local demand create a universal web of dependence. Capitalism is synonymous with this kind of decay. Capitalism is what happens when communal institutions begin falling apart. Without a strong monarchy, oligarchs take over. This is an iron law of civilized history. Those are the only two options. Monarchy, the common good, unity, focus on the one hand, or decay once the king has been killed, where self-interest rules and therefore a small group of oligarchs will rule. It's no accident that the essential message of the Old Testament prophets is that the rejection of Yahweh, which just means I am, and the acceptance of monetary civilization are one and the same thing. Oligarchy reduces men to primal, wild instinct. So through this kind of ideological manipulation, it's the alchemical ritual where orthodoxy slowly turned to heresy, because all heresy ultimately is social. The Old Testament makes that clear over and over again. Changes in doctrine usually are done ignorantly. It's done because society is disordered. You're not seeing reality anymore. Now, the Byzantine Empire was the New Jerusalem. Constantinople saw itself as that. The model of redeemed humanity, as much as humanly possible. This would be a very new type of society, as Constantine envisioned. In 1204, the Italians, with the more or less acceptance of the papacy, seized the empire and the gold and jewels and valuables of Constantinople were taken. And in fact, they were used to build the modern West. In the period of this populist revolt of the Zealot Party, Byzantium was in a state of decline, matched pretty much by the USA today. The domination of money, the transformation of constitutional and canonical rule into feudal dependence, the concentration of capital, of course, would be land in Byzantium, The concentration of capital into fewer and fewer hands was the norm. As things get more unstable and no one has any confidence in the future, no bank is going to lend money to anyone but the biggest and strongest institution. And even there, it's only done on a short-term basis. The class war in Byzantium was also a racial war, or an ethnic war. Italian merchants monopolized the wholesale foreign domestic trade of the empire. For the assistance of the West that never came against the Turks, the Byzantine Empire simply sold its soul. Its sovereignty was removed when the Florentines and Venetians were given tax-free status in the empire. The empire's Jews were immediate allies of the Italians, and also with the Muslims. The Jews, a handful of secular lords, merchants from the West, were given privileges while the peasantry fought their wars. No moral purpose was manifest in the state. You would think that an oligarch would have every interest in maintaining the military to protect himself. But people aren't rational. They realize that oligarchy is self-destructive. It doesn't matter. Like the Poles in the 18th century, the so-called Republican residents of Novgorod, an oligarchy will reduce the army to nothing. You see it in Albania today. You know, it's a criminal oligarchy who rules. They have no army whatsoever. A victorious emperor with a loyal army means doom to any decadence. If you're concerned primarily and exclusively with short-term asset stripping and nothing's actually being produced, then the army is left to rot. It's a threat. It's expensive. They're only seeing, and of course they could always use mercenaries if absolutely necessary. As with each and every other aspect of economic history, elites show themselves to be irrational, self-destructive, and completely ignorant of their so-called self-interest. Classical economics is completely backwards. People do things for irrational reasons. And there's nothing more, you know, manifest of this universal constant. We're talking about the middle of the 14th century in Byzantium. Emperor Andronicus III had died in 1341, and John V, Palaiologos, took his place. Very young. John Kenikouzenos became the regent for the young emperor. He relied on a large, powerful aristocracy and sort of the noble muster, you know, armed force or even mercenaries. And that actually becomes very, very important as time goes on. His opposition comes from the young emperor's mother, Anna of Savoy, Patriarch John the Cripple, Apriski. That was in very, very simple terms, those are the two pieces that were going to clash here in Byzantine history. It's just a specific manifestation of a universal ideal. The real issue, of course, is passion and desire. Self-interest versus the common good, as always. A civil war breaks out here, and it's really between Thessaloniki and Constantinople. The geographic division is not that important. It's a matter of usury. The rich support the regent. They use usury to maintain their power and slowly drain the wealth of society to themselves. And of course, the resulting war that they knew was going to happen destroyed any chance of a prosperous empire. So they're aware that they're being irrational. They're rare that this short-term thing will destroy them, and it doesn't bother them. One of the obnoxious things here is that they make the claim that Gregory Palamas, the great Hesychast philosopher, somehow supported the oligarchs. It's actually very, very obnoxious, and you have these alleged experts, both in Greek and in English, people making absolutely ridiculous statements. That somehow the monks, you know, in a very vague term, supported the landed aristocracy. Kostas Lampou, a Greek writer, says this idiotic comment. The zealots came into open confrontation with the dogmatism of the Hesychasts and Gregory Palamas, who praised monasticism, the strict rule and allegiance to the power of the landlords and the emperor. Well, no citation is given for that because it's absolutely absurd. I look at the origin of this idiotic statement, and it's something called Television Without Borders, which is a direct creation of George Soros. But that kind of garbage, the complete ignorance, having no idea what monasticism is, having no idea what Hesychism is, having no idea who Gregory Palamas is, this guy claims to be a scholar in Greek history. Here's another one. This is just pure intellectual laziness here. Let me quote here, also from Lampou. The zealots took measures towards intellectual freedom, freedom of speech, and religious tolerance. They abolished all privileges, the right of private property, and confiscated the wealth of nobility. Direct election was established for all government offices, courts, and religious offices. The wealth of the church was taken, and the separation of church and state was established. They established the status of equality before law, released their serfs, and gave equal rights to foreigners. This is the High Middle Ages, and they're talking about this. All this guy did is take his personal agenda and impose it on this aspect of Greek history. He just projects his own ideological demands on it. Not a word that I quoted to you is true. There is no evidence. There is no document. There is not even second-hand document that says they did any of those things. The intellectual apparatus for those kind of ideas didn't exist. He talks about, you know, equal rights to foreigners. That's an odd thing to mention. Well, it's not odd when these people, of course, are supporting migrants and refugees from the Middle East, because equality means equal rights to foreigners. The issue never came up. There were no nobles in the Byzantine Empire, since there was no system of ranked titles outside government service. The concept of nobility is laughable. This man, who is writing a very well-known paper on the topic, actually knows nothing. Freedom of speech in the abstract, of course, it didn't exist. They abolished the right of private property. Direct election was established. There is not a shred of evidence for this. He's simply making it up. And this happens all the time. And his primary concern is to make the church look bad by saying that Gregory Palamas and the Hesychast monks supported the opposite of all of those things. Well, St. Nicholas Cabasilas wrote the Oration Against Usury. Around the same time, Gregory Palamas wrote his own attack on usury. And the argument is simply that usury is taking from something that provides no value. It's taking money from itself. When a banker loans money and the investment fails, they still want their money back. In other words, it's only about the money, not the productive capacity. If it was the investment that mattered, then a failure of the investment would end the claim of the creditor. It's money, not production, that earns usury. It is occasionally claimed that these kind of interest rates on loans are it's okay, because the real concern is the business establishment that's being formed and the production that comes from it. And if that was the case, then they wouldn't want their money back if the business fails. The church was always very consistent, and Palamas and Cabasilas argue that surplus funds beyond necessities are not owned by anybody. There is no right to this. They're to be given to the poor. You compound the sin when you hoard money, and in hoarding, that leads to the manipulation of the poor. Profits here are not legitimate under any circumstances. any contract here is not being freely signed. Thessaloniki was a market-oriented city. It had a major naval base there. But civil war had destroyed the stability, and usually when that happens, contracts are void. Whenever a war breaks out, especially medieval societies, stratification of classes increases pretty radically. Because now you're looking for protection. You're not thinking long term, you're thinking survival. Katakouzenos was a symbol for the oligarchy, which means increasing stratification of class and concentration of land ownership, and their opposition we call the Zealot Party, which did remove oligarchs from the city. But the list that I mentioned to you simply doesn't exist. Here's an example of a writer, a so-called scholar in this field, simply making things up. And of course, it's Johnson's Law, because how many people are going to be able to reject this? How many people are going to be able to say no to this? The Zealots sought basic independence from the empire, and in the vaguest terms, some kind of a non-royal government. John V was installed largely through Italian cash. And as a result of that, he even sought a union with Rome for easy access to Italian money. In 1371, he became Roman Catholic. So there you have again the Old Testament notion. Sin leads to apostasy. Sin leads to a world that looks distorted. It's nothing more than the projection of your own desires. Andronicus IV was a son of John, and he used the Turks to gain the throne, while Italy had much to gain, of course, from promoting this division. This is the first time that Turks are brought into Europe. They're brought in irrationally to support the drive for power of Andronicus IV. He was willing to use the Turks to capture power. The Italians were used as balance. So John V went to Venice, Andronicus went to Genoa, and they wanted to see if they could divide the two oligarchical states from one another. That's when John went to the papacy to make his deal for power. And he went to Emir Murad. Andronicus went to Emir Murad to counter this move to the Italians. And his early victories led to Gallipoli being granted to the Ottomans as payment. The very first time something is given to the Turks in Europe. This is the first time it happens. And it's over nothing except drive for power. It is purely irrational. They didn't trust one another. They knew this was a bad thing. They did it anyway. John V, desperate for power, gives the entire foundation of Byzantine society away, the Orthodox Church. He doesn't care. He's not seeing reality. This is what sin does. Sin is a state of mind that can be the creation of a disordered society, or can create a disordered society. Either way, it's disorder within the mind. When you have this problem, so it's mental illness in the most vague sense, the world isn't real to you. It's just your desires. So this idiot writer here talking about the Zealots, he has no interest in history at all. All he's doing there is imposing his agenda on history, using terms that they could never possibly even use. Andronicus IV was able to win briefly using Turkish soldiers, and it led to the precedent of the tributary state of Byzantium. Both factions went to hostile foreigners for assistance. The Italians on the one hand and the Turks on the other. People aren't rational. You can't have a system that's founded on rational self-interest. So who are the Zealots? This is the interesting part here. The Zealot commune is something relatively new. It's something that you don't see a lot of in the East especially. But for 8 years, the Zealot party ruled the city. Now, normally in Byzantine society, a noble title was meaningless. Noble titles only went with government service. It didn't exist independently of that. The obnoxious claim that Gregory Palamas was on the side of the noble elite, they may have something to do with the fact that the patriarch of the usurper, John the Cripple, was an opponent of that movement. But the real motive is just to discredit the church. The Hesychast idea, you found it really in both camps. But I'm telling you something, the more I study, you know, I'm up to 27 years now of this kind of thing full time, and these kind of divisions, you know, possessors or non-possessors in Russia, monasticism versus humanism in Greece, they don't exist. They simply don't exist. These distinctions, these black and white moralistic approaches to society are never true. They're the result of intellectual laziness and the simple refusal to do the necessary work. And this is extremely, this guy is a alleged scholar in this field. And he's actually making things up. But the fact remains that you hear liberals and leftists of all stripes talking about the monks, the monastics, the church, which couldn't be any more vague, being this wealthy institution. The level of intellectual laziness there is laughable. The church, first of all, never gets defined. But the church men, people who run it at any given time, do not own the assets. It's not like, you know, it's in their own bank account. To this very day, you will hear professors talking about the wealthy church won't do anything. The church had tremendous wealth, etc. As if it's the same thing as his own bank account. No. These people, the church doesn't own these assets. They're allowed to use them for a while, but there's no concept of ownership in that regard. Unless you have a period of extreme corruption, a rich monastery doesn't make any sense. Or I should say, a rich monk doesn't make any sense. The office may have quite a bit of assets. But that has nothing to do with them as an individual. I'm going to do a lecture on the so-called possessors and non-possessors, which is a completely concocted medieval Russian ideological myth. And just like here in the Thessalonican case, it's a vehicle for professors to simply impose modern ideas onto the world. It's simply fantasy. It doesn't exist. Like most people, when I first studied Russia, I thought that, you know, Neil Sorsky and Joseph Volokh, I thought that these were opponents, that they hated each other, that, you know, they were two ideological camps. None of that is true. None of that is true. But we'll get to that some other point. People simply aren't rational. They do what's easy for them. They believe what they want to hear. And Johnson's law continues to function, especially in areas like this that are fairly obscure. But you have scholar after scholar talking about the Byzantine aristocracy. Well, there is no such thing. You know, some people are richer than others. Although keep in mind that only the modern era and the postmodern era has these massive distinctions in wealth. Someone who was wealthy in Byzantium was not that much better off than the peasants in the fields. They may have properties, but it wasn't a monetized economy. So talking about this income inequality is laughable. But the zealots, in this particular case, they did have an approach. The most we could figure out is that they sought the elimination of the nobility and the separation of the city from the empire. When I say nobility, I'm talking about the rule of those who have tentacles in the state apparatus. There's no noble title, but the state in this particular case was more powerful than economic elites, unlike today. So power went with either land or government office, and those two things were often conflated over time. They did fight the concentration of wealth in the hands of landed oligarchs. And the monastic acceptance of that was that landed wealth is not something worth pursuing, and it shouldn't be synonymous with power. The concept of political power and rule, medieval empires were not governments, they were not states, they were not nations. Everything was local. Everything was based on consensus. Forcing someone to do your bidding could only occur in the breach, not as a matter of course. Somebody didn't work that way. Things moved very slowly. Coercion was very expensive. And when it was done, it had to be done within a set of contracts. That means the context is this kind of consensus. But there is something called the Republic of Thessaloniki. Some people have gone so far as to call it a national anarchist commune. But we're talking about the decay of an empire here. Marcellus, another writer here, another fool, he says this about this movement. They confiscated a large part of the church property, namely the property of the rich monasteries. It's not a proof of the existence of hostility on their part to the church and monasticism. Now, the point here is, what he doesn't know is that Hesychius didn't own property. There was no claim that they could ever put forward to own anything. There isn't a single expropriation of church lands recorded anywhere at the time. The Hesychius movement was as close as you could get to anarchism in the Orthodox Church. They favored the small skete, the hermitage. They rejected formal hierarchy as a matter of course. You know, grace, freedom in this respect, dominated over the rule of offices, so to speak. But when you have a scholar using vague phrases like the church was rich and owned property, you know they don't know what they're talking about. The Palamites or the Hesychius, they were monks, right? Well, therefore they owned property, and therefore they were rich. That's the analysis here. You see this in Western European historical analysis as well as here in the East. It is true that Hesychism as a monastic form is political in the sense that there was really no distinction between culture and statecraft and canon law and economics. Only the moderns do we rip apart the human mind like this into these little compartments. It is absolutely and completely artificial. But when I say political, I really mean something that's social or legal. The critical distinction between essence and energy is not something that should be approached lightly by amateurs, and certainly shouldn't even be approached by anyone who is not well-schooled in Platonism. Think of it like this. Church doctrine, as well as heresy, is social. It has its root in social life. The distinction between the essence of a thing and the energy of a thing. The first consequence of this distinction is that the mind is no longer a separate faculty from everything else, but it's integrated into something more comprehensive, and that's the heart. It doesn't mean that the practical kind of utilitarian logic is somehow made into a theological idea. It is demoted, though. It's just something strictly formal. Reason becomes more like logic. They would never use a concept like logical analysis separated from the moral condition of the mind or the nature of social life at the time. And they would never say that because they realize people are irrational. It is very, very easy for a bad habit or some drive, like a drive for money or power, to destroy your ability to see anything. But what's happening here, going back to Byzantium, is that the utter and complete irrationality of these people. They know what they're doing is not in their interest. They know what they're doing is going to destroy the empire. They know what they're doing, that even if they win, they can't win for long because their policies of getting into office will destroy the system. Now, the supporters of John V pretty much fell apart due to yet another failed alliance with the Turks. But Anne of Savoy did the same thing. Also went to a Turkish faction. The Turks had destroyed Thrace. So on their way back from that part of Greece, they stopped over in Constantinople and demanded from Anna awards for their so-called service. They were told no, and then they razed the suburbs of the capital. Complete irrationality. Nothing here makes any sense. What they're doing is they're looking for power on a very short-term basis. The policies that they're engaging in will destroy the very foundation of the power they want. Refusing all conception of reason or self-interest, these people saw, and partially due to their policies, a very sharp deterioration of the empire itself. So even if they won, what they would get is semi-existing. It would be so weak as to be useless. The fleet, essential to the Byzantine Empire, was almost non-existent. The treasury was completely empty. The Venetians, of course, were there to pledge 30,000 ducats, and they got the jewels of the imperial crown. They're giving away sacred royal jewels and artifacts for a few dollars to keep themselves into power. But in this process, the army has fallen apart. The navy doesn't exist. So even if they win, there's nothing to win. And they're aware of this as they're doing it. The civil war between these factions is completely and utterly irrational, and this occurs all the time. They're mortgaging the state to the Turks, and therefore, even if they win, they'll end up being a vassal to them. Now, the point of this all, of course, is that the commune, the Saloniki, is connected to the monastic ideal. This is a way to get away from this kind of irrationality, to fight this kind of irrationality. The problem we have is that the presumption of secular, liberal, alienated urban academics trying to write about monasticism, which is the very opposite of what they are, and trying to write about it intelligently. It's like trying to write about ancient China and never mentioning Buddhism, or having no idea what that is. This is not a flippant exaggeration. This is how it is. And they get away with it. The disintegration of the state, decomposition as a result of deliberate elite choice, leads to the rise of oligarchy. Without central power, the elite factions seek to gain as much as possible before the system is gone. You see this in America today. There is no faith in the future, so the only incentive is to take what you can as quickly as possible. It's extremely rare to find exceptions to this. Because of these wars, the central state in Byzantium lost all legitimacy. And it didn't matter anyway because they were now servants of an overtly hostile power, whether it be Italy, the papacy, or Turkey. Because of their irrationality, then the landed elite made it worse and said, well, given the situation we created, we'll just do asset stripping and we'll fight for as short-term privileges before the whole thing falls apart. You can't have a system that is based on human rationality. You will get nowhere because people aren't rational. But the monastic idea, which was tightly connected to the zealots, which is the exact opposite of what these idiots are saying, But the monks and the zealot movement were aligned because they believed the same thing. Hesychism is a communal, really anarchist idea in terms of its own organization. It generally rejects formalized hierarchies. I mean, it recognizes their existence, but they don't have any moral or religious significance. And they sought the freedom and the grace that offered rather than the letter of a rule. It's not opposed to, you know, the larger monastery, but it does emphasize a more personal, less rigid approach to worship. And it's usually much stricter. But its most clear social idea is rejection of possessions. But all monks have to reject possession. Hesychism is essentially connected with the extreme rejection of property, of serfdom, and the consequent attachment to the power systems that ownership implies. In no way can Gregory Palamas or the Hesychist movement defend property or privilege. The very structure of monasticism itself rejects this totally and absolutely. On the other hand, landed elites saw the church as an economic inconvenience. Again, this is also almost a near universal constant, since when appetites are provoked and then whetted a little bit, they rarely come down of their own will. The commune and the Hesychist communal structure, they're very similar in their mission and purpose. But the opposite would be secular oligarchy, which is quite willing to convert to Islam or Catholicism if it maintains their property. The canons governing the Hesychist monastic idea also not only reject property, but any involvement in political affairs. So the tenured historian has to explain to me how the Palamite monastics committed open heresy, flouted their own canons and constitution, totally rejected its most fundamental ethical principles, sided adroitly with a political faction at the same time, have no one noticed. Now, the American history professor, he is adroit at ladder climbing, conformity, bureaucratic protocol, and self-interest, that's for sure. And I firmly believe that their vices are projected onto historical figures that they try to understand. I firmly believe that history departments, classical departments, you need to have mass firings. The ignorance and incompetence is so bad. And these people are so privileged. These universities have to be taken apart piece by piece. The central idea here, and the central idea in much of what I do politically, is that the landed interest, the interest of capital, once freed from the father figure of the central monarch, very quickly becomes mechanized. It becomes secular. It just collects things. But the primary thing it collects is neuroses. They're aware of their total illegitimacy. But the factions for political power were aware of this. They had no legitimacy, and they were completely destructive, even to their own interests. The zealots model themselves on the monastic idea, as much as we can figure out. It's experience with these egalitarian communes rejected ownership of anything that was a daily event. Monastics were anarchists and socialists, using those terms very generally, on a day-to-day basis. If the zealots were going to do that in a city, the monks would be the first person you would go to. But this logical concept is, anyway. There is a scholar, Donald Nicol, who is a bit less obnoxious than his younger understudies. But he is confused. He has a book out called The Last Centuries of Byzantium. And unlike, you know, usually most of these guys, he has no knowledge of Byzantine theology. And he provides no reason why these unnamed, always unnamed, zealots would hate Palamas so much. Palamas said the private property is equated with theft and murder. But Nicol, I guess, has missed all that. Typically, guys like this, they use political categories borrowed from modern republicanism to explain something that happened in the High Middle Ages. Look, emperors, and not just in Byzantium, but emperors who had questionable legitimacy and few resources, with few means of enforcement, had no means at their disposal to force anyone to do anything, let alone those who didn't own anything. You had no leverage against them. John already converted to papism in Rome. This didn't cause the disintegration of the Greek faith in Constantinople, did it? So the decisions of emperors, especially at a time of confusion, have no bearing whatsoever on theology. There isn't a single medieval emperor who had the ability to impose religion on anybody. Besides the fact that that assumes this religion is a private affair, individualism that's purely modern, they didn't have the resources for this. It never happened. They can't happen. Certain elites may accept it, but it takes generations and generations for this to bear fruit. No medieval state had this kind of power. It simply didn't exist. You can't use postmodern systems. You know, the states that we live in, the countries that we live in, and just say to yourself, well, the Middle Ages were just a slightly less efficient version of that. And to say that a great saint like Gregory Palamas was in favor of oligarchy and usury, which he spent his whole career condemning, shows you just how bad off these professors are. They really are fantasizing about this. And a guy by the name of Christos Malatras had to write an article about the mythology of the Zealots. You know, these people are saying that the Zealots were anti-religious. And they simply take modern leftist movements and say that's what these people are in the High Middle Ages. It's their neurosis that's being discussed here, not anything that happened in the 14th century. There was no middle class. This is purely projection. There were no popular assemblies. That didn't exist in the way these people are talking about. There was no redistribution of wealth because no one was powerful enough to do it. And wealth was largely land, and you can't redistribute that. It's not liquid like money is. The most you can get is that this is a separatist movement that was connected to a disgruntled faction of the aristocracy that made the proper point that oligarchy, as it always does, is destroying the society. There were solid economic, ethnic, and political reasons to seek revolution or separation in Byzantium. Trade was in Italian hands. Civil war was already was destroying an already weakened empire. And the ruling class was laughably decadent. Palamas and the Hesychus were a revolutionary, so to speak, revolutionary conception. That was at war with all of these things. The Byzantine idea was based on a free peasantry, strong monasteries, and they checked both bishops and the state. And of course, a noble class that was dedicated to national service. There was only nobles relative to the state, didn't exist on their own. But without these three pillars, the state fell and quickly disintegrated. By the death of my favorite Byzantine emperor, Basil II, in 1025, he created a professional civil service, speaking Greek, in both military and civilian areas. And as always, noble lust for power was the main issue. It was a feudal world, in the sense that feudalism is defined as the ability to charge high rents based on their social position, not on any good economic purpose. And they were in the process of destroying both the state and the peasantry. Makes matters worse, this Islam was resurgent. It was pressing on Byzantium from the south, while the west and saw the Normans and the Magyars to the north. Now we're talking several hundred years before this, but I just use this as an example. Basil II created the Byzantine idea that was falling apart during this civil war era. Basil II defined Byzantine political theory is based around a strong crown, dedicated almost entirely to military life, and, unfortunately, the constant surveillance of noble arrogance. Fiscal reform, I mean, we use that as a modern term, but it essentially came down to removing means by which the elite can charge rents. It took any excess liquidity out of the system. I mean, remember, you know, conquered people, the way that emperors and empires function, they didn't function in modern terms. Conquered people were never actually conquered. They were liberated from a previous ruling class, and in the old Roman idea, should be treated better than their former overlords. Taxes were low. Since high taxes never benefited the state, it was usually diverted to noble hands anyway. The only thing that an emperor could do, really, is increase punishments for breach of contract and centralize offices. The most we could come up in terms of the zealot communal movement, based around a few issues. Number one, the autonomy of urban society against the irrational behaviors of these late emperors. The city is a counterweight to the landed interest, which was synonymous with the oligarchy at the time. In other words, the land and the mercantile were contrasted. There was a strong ethnic component because you had Italian privilege coming from its banking establishment, and they used to manipulate the appetites of these emperors to lure them into a debt relationship, which is far more powerful than any conquest. The rich versus poor concept, that's a modern concept. When Christ made reference to the poor in spirit, he wasn't talking about people who couldn't pay their credit card bill. He was referring to those who refused to use a credit card in the first place, if you get what I mean. The hesychastic skeet idea is essential here. It gave cities the opportunity to create coalitions against the ruling class. The navy and the merchant marine had fallen apart, which was the lifeblood of the Byzantine economy. The zealot movement joined with some of these classes. A civil war rages, and land and money are concentrated into smaller circles of power. Only a big landowner could survive an onslaught like that. It wasn't a protest against the Byzantine state or monarchy. It was a protest of its absence and its debasement. And the worst aspect of this is that they had gone to the Turks for assistance. And of course, as society begins falling apart, as Kadosonov said in the beginning of this thing, society falls apart, you have a rise of usury and moneylenders. They are at the root of all urban revolt, and most certainly, given the events of the period, the Thessaloniki was not an exception. From the end of the 13th century to the end of the empire, it was fragmenting politically, economically, and every other way. Even the imperial coin was driven out, and by roughly the 1350s, the Venetian gold ducat was the currency of Constantinople. And civil wars destroyed what was left. The zealots, the monastics, ideologically speaking, were a very, very powerful counterweight to the irrationality of sin. Start off talking about these things, they seem very obscure. No one knows about the zealot commune and Thessalonica. But what historians are supposed to do is talk about the general human condition while understanding the specifics of these conflicts. It all comes down to whether we're able to perceive the world as it is, or if the world is nothing more than a result of our projection and representation. The distortion of the outside world comes from sin. When you're driven by this passion to have something, money, whatever it is, the entire world starts to look like that. Gregory Palamas and the monastics, by their very constitution, were egalitarians, communalists. Now, the zealots were violent. Palamas condemns usury and all and rent over and over again. He says inequality in economics has no foundation. But he does reject the mob mentality of the zealot movement. But then you have, you know, a Harvard professor who will look at this and say, ah, Palamas condemned the zealots. And then says, well, he must be a partisan of the wealthy. You know, this is a laziness that exists in academia today. This is what tenure creates. There was no crisis of feudalism. But we can talk about capitalism being the same as Italian oligarchy. There was no desire for a new system. The destruction of the old system was the problem. The Byzantine Empire was still dominated by Latin feudal lords from the 1204 sack of Constantinople. The rebellion of the zealots was that tradition was falling apart, was that the state and the system weren't functioning the way they were supposed to. No one wanted revolution. The concept didn't exist. No one believed that one state could be replaced by another. You know, natural law is natural law. So you have this radical ideological movement like the zealots, connected with the monks, Gregory Palamas and the Hesychast movement, where you have this agrarian, smallholding, populist, really, non-hierarchical series of communities. But what begins to happen is that as society fragments in the way that we've talked about, and societies do as they die, the rebellion comes into existence that it's its negation, or trying to negate it. Commercial oligarchies don't like land empires, and they don't like them gaining power. So the battle here is between a true monarch, a true emperor on the one hand, and the oligarchical city-state on the other hand. It's very difficult for modern professors to accept any of this, because they want to believe that the ruling class in the Middle Ages were all one group. Monarchs were at war with the aristocracy. There was nothing, you know, this movement wasn't anti-royalist. It wasn't even used the word liberal in this case. The magnates and the emperor were opposites. The problem was the decay of imperial power, not imperial power as such. There was no prize here. Byzantium had fallen to almost nothing. People are irrational. The poor, the merchants, lower-level merchants, and the monks were cooperating. Byzantium never recovered from 1204. Christendom never recovered from 1204. But empires decay based on sin. They decay because people's passion, their drives, color the world around them. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.